Welcome, dear listeners, to another episode of A Dark Cup of Histity. And in some ways, this is a first for us. We're doing another true fairy tale. We've already done the darker side of the stories behind Cinderella, Pinocchio, Beauty and the Beast, and the Snow Queen. But they didn't need to, in our eyes, be part of the Dark Cup episodes. This one, however, definitely needs to.
It does also need to come with a warning. Sleeping Beauty surpasses all in terms of gore, abuse, and essentially the worst capabilities of humankind. The Disney princess's curse to sleep until she's awoken with true love's kiss is already a little shaky by today's standards, but Disney's version is a far cry from the creepy 17th century original.
This episode will include mentions of child abuse, cannibalism, and rape. Listener discretion is advised.
And in this week's Ridiculous Death, we discuss why you should never trust a fart when your life is on the line.
So, sit back, grab a drink of something strong, and join us once upon a dream, or nightmare. And let's get dark. So, we're going to start with a few details of the story, as we normally do, before we then go in and we'll tell the story as it was written.
Okay.
So, the story of Sleeping Beauty has been known by many names before it came across the desk of Walt Disney in the 1950s.
Early contributions to the tale include the Provençal versified novel Frères de joie et sœurs de plaisir.
Well done, Jesus!
written circa 1320 to 1340, and the medieval courtly romance Perceforest, published in 1528.
However, the earliest full tale was called The Moon Sir. No, it wasn't. It was called The Sun, Moon, and Talia. In Italian, it was
Sole, Luna, Italia.
Written by
Giambattista Basile.
In his 1634 work, the
Pentamerone. Charles Perrault, whom we've spoken about before, as he also wrote the original Cinderella, or Ashputtel, retold this fairy tale in 1697 as The Sleeping Beauty.
And then the infamous Brothers Grimm retold it once more in 1812, and they called it Little Briar Rose.
Which sounds sweet, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Was it not sweet?
It actually is a lot better than the others, and we'll discuss that a bit later on, yeah.
The Grimm's brother were better than the others?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, okay, okay.
Well, you know things have fucked up when the Grimm brothers realise that maybe it's too dark for them to tell.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
But more on the adaptations later. For now, we're going to, as with other episodes, read you the full, most original tale as written by Basile, obviously translated, because we're not fluent in Italian.
No, we're not. So, as we said before, the story will contain abuse, rape, and cannibalism, but we're just reading it as it was written.
Yeah, so if you're uncomfortable with any of that, stop now. We won't judge
you. Yeah, or skip about 20 minutes forward. But, and here's the story. There once lived a great lord who was blessed with the birth of a daughter, whom he named Talia. He sent for wise men and astrologers in his lands to predict her future. They met, counselled together, and cast her horoscope, and at length they came to the conclusion that she would incur great danger from a splinter of flax. Her father, therefore, forbade that any flax, hemp, or any other material of that sort be brought into his house, so that she should escape this predestined danger.
Just a point. I have never in my life read a horoscope that was that specific. It's always like, oh, you're going to have positive vibes today, or abundance is coming your way, or you'll meet a tall, dark stranger. In my case, it's usually tall, dark, and damaged, let's be honest. But I've never met one that's gone, on this day of this year, within your life, you'll be pricked by a spindle and fall asleep.
Yep. But no, this was flax.
Honestly.
Flax splinter.
Horoscopes, up you go. One day, when Talia had grown into a young and beautiful lady, she was looking out of a window when she beheld passing that way an old woman who was spinning. Talia, never having seen a distaff or spindle, was pleased to see the twirling spindle, and she was so curious as to what thing it was that she asked the old woman to come to her. Taking the distaff from her hand, she began to stretch the flax. Unfortunately, Talia ran a splinter of flax under her nail, and she fell dead upon the ground. When the old woman saw this, she became frightened and ran down the stairs and is running still.
Yep, she just continued to run.
We forget about her now. She's just constantly running.
She's running.
Yeah.
As soon as the wretched father heard of the disaster which had taken place, He had them. After having paid for his tub of sour wine with casks of tears, lay her out into one of the country mansions.
Sour wine and casks of tears?
Yep.
Okay, wow.
There they seated her on a velvet throne under a canopy of brocade, wanting to forget all and to drive from his memory his great misfortune. He closed the door and abandoned forever the house where he had suffered his great loss.
So they didn't actually bury her, they just left her there?
They left her on a velvet throne in a mansion, closed the doors and never went back.
But she'd just basically be left there to skeletize, I don't even know if that's a word, but decompose,
die.
Lovely.
It's like a massive version of like a mausoleum, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
They've just put her in this house and closed the doors.
After a time, it happened by chance that a king was out hunting and he passed that way. One of his falcons escaped from his hand and flew into the house by way of one of the windows. It did not come when he called, so the king had one of his party knock at the door, believing the palace to be inhabited. Although he knocked for a length of time, nobody answered, so the king had them bring a vintner's ladder, for he himself would climb up and search the house to discover what was inside. Thus he climbed up and entered, and looked in all the rooms and nooks and corners, and was amazed to find no living person there.
At last he came to the salon, and when the king beheld Talia, who seemed to be enchanted, he believed that she was asleep, and he called her, but she remained unconscious. Crying aloud, he beheld his charms and felt his blood course hotly through his veins. He lifted her in his arms and carried her to a bed, where he gathered his first fruits of love.
Okay.
Leaving her on the bed, he returned to his own kingdom, where, in the pressing business of his realm, he, for a time, thought no more about the incident.
Now, after 9 months, Talia delivered two beautiful children, one a boy and the other a girl. In them could be seen two rare jewels, and they were attended by two fairies, who came to that palace and put them at their mother's breasts. Once, however, they sought the nipple and, not finding it, began to suck on Talia's fingers, and they sucked so much that the splinter of flax came out. Talia awoke as if from a long sleep, and seeing behind her two priceless gems, she held them to her breast and gave them the nipple to suck, and the babies were dearer to her than her own life.
Finding herself alone in that palace with two children by her side, she did not know what had happened to her, but she did not notice that the table was set and food and drink were brought into her, although she did not see any attendants.
In the meanwhile, the king remembered Talia, and saying that he wanted to go hunting, he returned to the palace and found her awake and with two cupids of beauty. He was overjoyed, and he told Talia who he was and how he had seen her and what had taken place. When she heard this, their friendship was knitted with tighter bonds, and he remained with her for a few days. Yeah, we're just going to gloss over that. After that time, he bade her farewell and promised to return soon and take her with him to his kingdom. And he went to his realm, but he could not find any rest, and at all hours he had in his mouth the names of Talia and of Sun and Moon. Those were the two children's names. And when he took his rest, he called either one or other of them.
Now, the king's wife began to suspect that something was wrong from the delay of her husband while hunting, and hearing him name continually, Talia, Sun, and Moon, she became hot with another kind of heat in the suns. Sending for the secretary, she said to him, "Listen to me, my son, you are living between two rocks, between the post and the door, between the poker and the grate. If you will tell me with whom the king, your master, and my husband is in love, I will give you the treasures untold. And if you hide the truth from me, you will never be found again, dead or alive." The man was terribly frightened, understandably. Greed and fear blinded his eyes to all honour and to all sense of justice. He related to her all things, calling bread and bread and wine wine.
That just means he was basically telling her the truth.
Yep, telling her everything.
So the queen, hearing how matters stood, sent the secretary to Talia in the name of the king, asking her to send the children, for he wished to see them. Talia, with great joy, did as she was commanded. Then the queen, with a heart of Medea, took the cook to kill them and made them into several tasteful dishes for her wretched husband. Medea, just as an FYI, was the wife of Jason, as in Jason and the Argonauts, and to get revenge on him for cheating on her, she killed her own children. But the cook was tender-hearted, and seeing these two beautiful golden apples, felt pity and compassion for them, and he carried them home to his wife and had her hide them. In their place, he prepared two lambs into 100 different dishes. When the king came, the queen, with great pleasure, had the food served.
The king ate with delight, saying, "By the life of Lanfusa, how tasteful this is," or, "By the soul of my ancestors, this is good." Each time she replied, "Eat, eat, you are eating of your own." For two or three times the king paid no attention to this repetition. But at last, seeing that the music continued, he answered, "I know perfectly well what I am eating is my own, because you have brought nothing into this house."
Ooh.
And growing angry, he got up and went to a villa for some distance from his palace, to solace his soul and alleviate his anger.
In the meanwhile, the queen, not being satisfied of the evil already done, sent for the secretary and told him to go to the palace and bring Talia back, saying that the king longed for her presence and was expecting her. Talia departed as soon as she heard these words, believing that she was following the commands of her lord, for she greatly longed to see her light and joy, knowing not what was preparing her for her. She was met by the queen, whose face glowed from the fierce fire burning inside her, and looked like the face of Nero.
She addressed her thus, "Welcome, Madam Busybody. You are a fine piece of goods, you ill weed, who are enjoying my husband. So, you are the lump of filth, the cruel bitch that has caused my head to spin. Change your ways, for you are welcome in purgatory, where I will compensate you for all the damage you have done to me."
Ooh, she mad.
She angry.
Talia, hearing these words, began to excuse herself, saying that it was not her fault, because the king, her husband, had taken possession of her territory when she was drowned in sleep. But the queen would not listen to her excuses, and had a large fire lit in the courtyard of the palace, and commanded that Talia should be cast into it. Well, that's victim blaming.
The lady, perceiving that matters had taken a bad turn,
just
knelt before the queen, and begged her to allow her at least to take off the garments she wore. The queen, not for pity of the unhappy lady, but to gain also those robes, which were embroidered with gold and pearls, told her to undress, saying, "You can take off your clothes, I agree." Talia began to take them off, and with every item that she removed, she uttered a loud scream. Having taken off her robe, her skirt, the bodice, and her shift, she was on the point of removing her last garment when she uttered a last scream louder than the rest. They dragged her towards the pile to reduce her to a light ashes, which would be used to wash the current's breeches.
The king suddenly appeared, and finding this spectacle, demanded to know what was happening. He asked for his children and his wife, reproaching him for his treachery, told him that she had them slaughtered and served to him as meat. When the wretched king heard this, he gave himself up to despair, saying, "Alas, then I myself am the wolf of my own sweet lambs, and alas, why did these, my veins, not know the fountains of their own blood? You renegade bitch, what evil deed is this which you have done? Begone, you shall get your desert as the stumps, and I will not send such a tyrant-faced one to the Colosseum to do her penance." There's so much Greek and Roman references in this, it's making my brain swim.
So saying, he commanded that the queen should be cast into the fire, which she had prepared for Talia, and the secretary with her, because he had been the handle for this bitter play, and weaver of this wicked plot. He was going to do the same with the cook, whom he believed to be the slaughterer of his children. When the man cast himself at his feet, saying, "In truth, my lord, for such a deed there should be nothing else than a pyre of living fire, and no other help than a spear from behind, and no other entertainment than twisting and turning within the blazing fire, and I should seek no other honour than to have my ashes, the ashes of a cook, mixed up with the queen's, but this is not the reward that I expect for having saved the children. In spite of the gall of that bitch, you wanted to kill them and return to your body that which was of your own body."
I feel at that point he could have just said, "Nah, bro, they're alive."
Wouldn't have the same ring to it in there.
Well, no, but it probably would have taken less time as he was being dragged towards a roaring fire.
Well, yeah, in fact.
Hearing these words, the king was beside himself. He thought he was dreaming, and he could not believe what his own ears had heard. Therefore, turning to the cook, he said, "If this is true that you have saved my children, be sure that I will take you away from turning the spit, and I'll put you in the kitchen of this breast, to turn and twist as you like all my desires, giving you such a reward as shall enable you to call yourself a happy man in this world."
While the king spoke these words, the cook's wife, seeing her husband's need, brought forth the two children, Sun and Moon, before their father, and he never tired at playing the game of three with his wife and children, making a mill wheel of kisses, now with one and then with the other. He gave a generous reward to the cook. He made him a chamberlain. He married Talia to wife, and she enjoyed a long life with her husband and her children, thus experiencing the truth of the proverb,
"Those whom fortune favours find good luck even in their sleep."
The end.
I would not call any of that good luck.
So, dissecting the true story of Sleeping Beauty, the beginning bit, where it is foretold she's going to prick her finger and die.
Yeah, her dad does everything he reasonably can to try and stop that. That's fine. It doesn't happen anyway. Like, it happens anyway. It doesn't stop it, you know.
Yeah.
Every single time people in history and mythology have tried to avert their fate still happens. You cannot avert
it. That's kind of the point of fate, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. People still try. I mean, Oedipus tried, and yeah, that did not end well for him or his mother. But, you know, it's, you can't avoid fate. But he tried. He's a father, he's trying for his daughter, you get that.
But then a king passing by sees the body of someone who he believes to be dead.
Yeah, but, you know, he's kind of looking. She's been there for a couple of months.
And he rapes her. Okay, they don't say it as rape. They say it as he takes her over to the bed. And
the fruit of love blooms. It's like, no. He looked at dead body, thought with downstairs brain.
But it's not just rape. It's also got a little hint of necrophilia thrown in there,
yeah,
too.
He had no confirmation. I mean, it's fair to say that we know at this point she was enchanted. He probably could have done some checks to make sure, yeah, she's still breathing a little bit. We don't know what his idea of first aid was.
No.
But even so, consent.
But even in this, it says in the story, he says her name a couple of times, she doesn't respond.
Yeah.
So he just takes her and does it.
Yeah.
And then leaves.
Yeah.
And doesn't think of her again.
And he has a wife.
Yep, and he just doesn't think about her again. But then in biology, she then has the babies.
Yeah.
She's still unconscious and asleep at this point, and she gets pregnant. She has a pregnancy and she has labour, all still while sleeping.
I mean, I'm assuming her body would involuntarily push the children out.
I'm guessing so, it happened. Or she had two fairies with her. They may have helped.
True, they could have done. But, you know, that happens, and that could have gone horribly, horribly wrong, as childbirth often does. And then she's, all of a sudden, the children aren't eating. They're not suckling. So the children could have died of malnutrition. They then decide, you know what, I'm going to suckle the finger. They take the splinter out. Firstly, what happens to the splinter? Does the child swallow the splinter?
I don't know. That is not said.
That should be said. But then she suddenly comes around to find that her entire family has vanished. It's probably been at least, what, a year, maybe two, since her dad's gone. She's probably lying still in blood and whatever else comes out at the time, because you have no control over your bowels in that moment. And there are two babies there that happen to look a lot like her.
Yep, and then the king does eventually think, oh, you know that woman that I had sex with without her knowledge? I'm going to go back and see her again.
Yeah.
And then, like...
Round two.
Yeah, but they talk. He says, oh, you're the woman I had sex with when she didn't know.
And she was fine with
and
it.
And she's like, oh, this makes us stronger. This brings us together.
So we are better friends for it.
Don't understand.
And
that's all before the cannibalism happens.
But he doesn't tell her he has a wife.
Nope. This is all before the cannibalism happens.
I understand his wife being mad. I get that.
Oh, yeah, and get her being a bit...
But
a
mad
bit
at him. Don't be mad at the kids. Be mad at him.
Yeah, she is.
And she's like, oh, I shall
she's
get revenge.
She's that mad, she's going to let... She thinks that she's fed her husband his kids.
Yeah, here, have a baby pie.
Luckily, the cook was nice.
Yeah. Finally.
Yeah. And then at the end, the wife is thrown into a fire.
Yeah.
She actually, if you forget what she tried to do with the cannibalism, this woman did nothing wrong.
No.
She was just being his wife. He cheated. He was a criminal. He had kids with someone else. And then she's the one that gets thrown into the fire.
Exactly. And we don't know if he had kids from that marriage as well, that are then having to deal with all this trauma, and all of a sudden, bang, there's a new mom and new kids. It's like, what?
And then they did live happily ever after.
Yeah.
And apparently the proverb of the whole story was those whom fortune favours find good luck even in their sleep. I don't think that was luck.
No, I think there's going to be some severe PTSD issues that they need to work through right now.
Right. But what I don't get is how you see that story, because that is the one, and think, you know, this would make a really good child's fairy tale.
Yeah.
So dark.
The thing is, fairy tales usually have a moral and a meaning to them. What is the moral and meaning to this? That it's okay to cheat on your wife?
Those whom fortune favours find good luck even in their sleep.
That's not a proverb.
Honestly, like, I know that we said with Ashputtel when we did Cinderella was dark and the Snow Queen and Pinocchio, but
there's a difference between dark, because those ones are dark and you're like, oof, that's not good. But there are a few that actually make me uncomfortable, and that one makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the thought that this defenceless woman was thought to have been dead.
Yeah. And he did what he wanted anyway. And then just thought it was okay to go home and forget about her. And he had children and took no responsibility until he was forced to.
Well, he didn't know he had the children until he went back.
Well, yeah, until he went back. But at that point, he then went home again.
After a few days playing daddy.
But it's okay, because he kept thinking about her all the time.
Yeah, and said their names in their sleep.
Yeah.
I mean, ridiculous names, Sun and Moon.
I don't really suppose she had much really thought to it. She probably was just like, I have a child, the sun is setting, the moon is rising. Oh yeah, sun and moon, cool.
No, I think I've read somewhere that it was, because it was the first thing she thought about in the morning and the last thing she thought about in the evening.
That's sweet.
Like the sun and the moon.
That is sweet.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't name my own children Sun and Moon, but it is sweet.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, there's someone on TikTok I follow that's named her child Midnight.
That's cool.
Mm. She got a lot of backlash for it.
Probably. But yeah. You know what? Who knows that, like, the names that we've got nowadays, what they would have been thought about back then, so...
I mean, Emily was quite common.
Emily's common in horror films. Says the one who's named after a horror novel.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But, so that's the story of Sleeping Beauty. There's nothing good I can really say about it. It's all horrid.
It's a very flowery language.
Yeah, but because it was Italian.
Yeah.
And a lot of it didn't really make sense translated, but that's because that's the best they could do.
Yeah.
To translate it from Italian to English.
Yeah, nothing really directly translates. There's always context and everything to it.
Yes. But let us know what you think of that horrible story. But we're now going to talk more on... We're going to continue on Sleeping Beauty and talk about the variations of the different ones that there have been since.
Yep.
So, we're going to start with her name. The princess's name has varied from one adaptation to the other. Like, in the story we just read, her name is Talia.
Yeah.
She, in the Perrault story, she doesn't have a name.
Okay.
But her daughter is called Aurore.
Okay, which means, like... Son or lion.
Yeah. The Brothers Grimm named her Briar Rose in their 1812 collection. However, some translations of the Grimm's tale does give the princess's name as Rosamond.
I like Rosamond.
Yeah. Tchaikovsky's ballet and Disney's version named her the Princess Aurora after, obviously, the Perrault's daughters had Aurora.
Yeah.
But then Disney also had her called Briar Rose in her childhood when she's being raised incognito by the good fairies.
Yeah.
So the Disney, this kind of proves that Disney took all of the different variations of this fairy tale, in inverted commas, and decided to keep Aurora and Briar Rose, which I quite like. It's kind of keeping true to two versions of the story. Yeah,
it's acknowledging them.
Yeah, I do. I
definitely not going as dark.
Pardon?
Whilst not going as dark. While she sleeps, Italo Calvino included a variant in Italian folk tales. In this version, the cause of the princess's sleep is a wish by her mother. In the one we just read, she got a splinter, and in the Brothers Grimm tale of Little Briar Rose, it's revealed to the king at a banquet celebrating his daughter's birth that Briar Rose will prick her finger on a spinning wheel and die.
Yeah, so they all kind of have a variation that she's going to die or go to sleep.
Yeah,
but they're all different reasons why.
Yeah.
So, the ending. All variations end with the prince and the princess living happily ever after, in whatever way they can. But, and somewhat unlike for the Grimm's Brothers Grimm, like I said earlier, their story ends when the prince kisses the princess awake, nothing more.
Okay.
So, they kind of have the lead up to what we know in the Disney movie and into the others, that she pricks her finger. But then she's being kissed, she wakes up, the end.
Okay.
The others have obviously the horrible rape and possible eating of said children before the happiness, but the Disney version sticks closer to that of the Brothers Grimm version, thankfully, which is very odd. You wouldn't think that, because Brothers Grimm have usually been the ones that you go to for the horrible telling of the stories.
But what if the Brothers Grimm had, like, you know, their Picasso blue period sort of thing, where they thought, let's there's so much darkness going on in the world right now, let's just be happy for about 5 minutes, and let's just end the story now. I like to think, because it's the two brothers, one of them just turned to the other and is like, okay, no, we're just going to leave it there. We're going to leave it. Yeah, oh, but then this happened. No, we're going to leave it.
We don't need to include the horrible, complete horrible. Yeah. Ash Putel, yeah, we can include the fact that the sisters chopped their feet off to fit into the shoes.
Or dance on hot coals and had their eyes pecked out.
Yeah, but we don't need to do necrophilia rape.
Yeah, so that is...
You know it's bad when Brothers Grimm are like, oh, no, we ain't touching that.
Yeah. It's like, no, let's not go there.
Yeah, so let's talk now about the Disney version.
Which I would say is probably the most known variation, so we're going to give a few small bits of info that we found interesting.
Yes, Sleeping Beauty, I will say, is my favourite of the Disney princess movies.
Yeah.
Obviously, everyone has their princess. I love Princess Aurora. I like the story of...
Hey, you know what? I can't
Disney's
comment.
Version.
My favourite is a story about Stockholm Syndrome and kidnap, so I can't.
Yeah, but this is the Disney versions that are fluffy and nice and happy and and cuddly. And there's just something about Sleeping Beauty that I like. That I like that she... the guy has to do a lot to save her.
Yeah,
like
he has to prove
in
it.
Snow White, Prince Florian just kisses her.
Yeah.
In Beauty and the Beast, he's a bit of an ass, but has to make her love her. But in Sleeping Beauty, he has to, like, go and fight. He has to, like, go through an entire forest of thorns. He has to fight and kill a dragon. He has to, like, break the curse, even before
he
then
gets... Doesn't he get captured for a while, and he's in he prison? So he has to escape prison as well. So he has to really prove it and put his
Prince
life on
Philip
online.
Prince Philip is pretty hardcore.
He is.
But I just... And then I also walked down the aisle to... Once Upon a Dream.
Yes.
So it is like, has a special place for me. Not the evil one we've just read.
No.
That
Sleeping
one.
Beauty does.
Sleeping Beauty.
This one.
Talia, Sun and Moon does not.
No.
But Sleeping Beauty was actually released on the 29th of July.
Ah.
Yeah.
Someone's birthday.
In 1959. And it was the last princess movie that Walt Disney was actually directly involved with. And he was so proud of the film that he featured her castle as the focal point for his Disneyland park in Anaheim, California.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be Sleeping Beauty, Snow White's castle, because it's,
right.
the first one. But no, it was coinciding, the opening of Disneyland was coinciding with the make of Sleeping Beauty, and he wanted that, so that's why it's Sleeping Beauty's castle.
And isn't it Sleeping Beauty's at Paris as well?
Yes.
Because I've never been to Anaheim, but they've got Maleficent's dragon underneath, haven't they?
They have in Paris too.
I know in Paris. Yes. I've seen the one in Paris. I didn't know.
Yeah, they do.
That's cool.
Yes, very cool.
As stated above, Disney chose to include two variations of the name, with Aurora being her true princess name, and Briar Rose as her hidden identity. To the princess Aurora.
Toodly-doo. Prince Philip is said to have been named after another royal that Americans would have been familiar with during that time period. Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, was the husband of Queen Elizabeth II.
Oh.
They had only been married for 12 years at the time that Sleeping Beauty was released, and Elizabeth had only been queen for just 7 years, but that's when Prince Philip was named after Prince Philip.
So we actually had a Disney prince on the throne.
We did.
That's so cool. That means it's real.
It does. 100%.
Instead of three quirky fairies, the original version included 7, as in Perrault's story. Other versions including up to 13, making the evil fairy the unlucky addition, because, you know, 13.
Mm-hmm.
The gifts the 7 fairies bestowed in Perrault's tale were beauty, wit, grace, dance, song, and music. In Disney's Sleeping Beauty, this was truncated to beauty and song, with the third wish being that the princess would sleep if she pricked her finger instead of dying.
Yeah, because in, obviously, the christening scene, Maleficent comes in and is like, you're going to die. And Meriwether is like, no, I have a wish left. I can't change it completely, but I can make her sleep instead of die. But yeah. Mary Costa provided the voice for Aurora. Aurora?
Aurora.
Aurora! Mary Costa provided the voice for Aurora. Helen Stanley was the live-action reference, but and she also served as the live-action reference for Cinderella and Anita in 101 Dalmatians.
Oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm. So they like watched her movements and then drew her?
Yeah.
Inspiration for Princess Aurora's features and body type came from Audrey Hepburn.
She was quite big back then.
Yeah.
When fairies discuss how to help the king and queen early on in the film, Merryweather, who is the blue fairy in Sleeping Beauty, makes cookies in the shape of a classic Mickey Mouse head, which is a hidden Mickey for all you diehard Disney fans.
Yeah, because there's always a hidden Mickey in everything, isn't there?
Pretty much.
Sleeping Beauty was such a box office bomb, at least compared to the cost of production, that the company decided that princess movies weren't exactly the wave of the future. They didn't make another movie until 30 years later, when The Little Mermaid was released in 1989, which is when we were born and we were riding the wave of the Disney Renaissance.
We were. But yeah, so that's Sleeping Beauty, the dark truth behind the story.
Yeah, that's pretty dark. I like that you ended it on a Disney segment to be like, lighter.
I felt like it needed it.
Yeah.
I felt like we couldn't have an entire thing when we spoke about rape and cannibalism of children.
No.
And child abuse and then be like, here you go. I felt like it needed, like Disney does when he takes the horrid fairy tales and make them into Disney movies. I felt that we needed to take the horrid of a podcast and give it a fluffy ending.
Agreed. Agreed. I'm 100% behind that.
Yeah. So, let us know what you think of that. Apologies if it was triggering or anything, but we did give a warning at the beginning, which I hope you heeded if you needed to.
Yeah.
So now we're going to go on to a segment that we do called Ridiculous Death.
Yeah, because, you know what, we're going to try and lighten it up a little bit because that was dark.
Yeah.
It was dark. So, have you ever heard of the name Arius the Heretic?
No, I haven't.
Well, Arius was around the time of the Emperor Constantine and the Council of Nicaea, which set out how the Bible is today as we see it.
Okay.
But he had a very distinct view. So there is the belief that God is almighty and divine and perfect.
Yep.
And that Jesus Christ is his son, but also his spirit in human form made flesh and is also divine and perfect.
Fair.
Arius did not believe that. Arius believed that only God could be divine and perfect, and that Jesus Christ, being human in nature, even though he was divine, was completely fallible. So he was prone to corruption.
Okay.
Church did not like this. Did not like this at all, and branded him a heretic, and basically excommunicated him. He seemed to gather a lot of followers, though, and he used a lot of philosophy to try and support his argument. And he was apparently quite well-spoken, quite intelligent, and it convinced people. And eventually he got in well with the Byzantine Empire, and they didn't quite support what he was saying, but they appreciated that he probably shouldn't be excommunicated. So they thought, you know what, we'll try and worm our way back into it.
Okay.
And they said, you know what, let's welcome him back into the church and let's give him communion. Let's give him the body of Christ to show that he's welcome back into the church.
That's nice.
It is. Didn't happen, though.
Okay.
As he was processing towards the church, it's believed that the Pope, who was being overruled by the Byzantine Emperor at the time, had prayed that God would make it so that Arius would never have the communion in his body.
Okay.
As they were processing, Arius was overcame by really, really strong stomach cramps, really bad. And people believe he was poisoned.
Okay.
For this to happen. So he was like, I'm really sorry, I've got to go, I've got to relieve myself. Here is the description of it, of what happened next.
Actual written description. Okay.
This was written by historian Socrates Scholasticus. Okay, this is a pretty impressive name. As he approached the place called Constantine's Forum, where the column of porphyry is erected, a terror arising from the remorse of conscience seized Arius, and with the terror a violent relaxation of the bowels. He therefore inquired where a convenient bathroom would be nearby, and being directed to the back of Constantine's Forum, he hasted thither. Soon after, a faintness came over him, and together with the evacuation of his bowels protruded, followed by a copious hemorrhage and the descent of the smaller intestines. Moreover, portions of his spleen and liver were bought off in the effusion of blood, so that he almost immediately died. So basically, he had a really bad stomach cramp, think it was the squits, ran to find a toilet, and essentially shit out his bowels, his intestines, his spleen, everything, hemorrhaged and died. But he never got the communion. And for a while afterwards, because he was still a heretic at that point, his bathroom where he died was actually like a mocking place for Christians. They'd go and they'd point and laugh at it.
That's so horrible.
Until one of his followers bought it and demolished it.
Well, that's good. That's mean.
Yep. But yeah, never poor trust Matt. A fart when your soul is on the line.
He shit himself.
Yes. He literally shit his innards out.
I didn't think they were positioned that way.
It prolapsed and it all just went bloop. And he hemorrhaged and died.
Holy fuck.
Yeah, or unholy in this case.
Hey. Oh my god, that is...
That is...
Oh dear.
Yep.
I guess the dude was right. He was never going to get communion in his body.
No, I mean, it kind of... It lends credence to the fact of praying it'll happen, but Jesus H.
Right.
Yep.
Right. After that, we just have one last small little segment that we add to the end of our podcast.
Yep. Yes, our segment, Carrie's Random Fact. Do-do-do-do-do, Carrie's Random Fact. So, we're going to keep it with kind of holy, unholy sort of thing here. Pope Gregory the Ninth, he declared that black cats were things of Satan and actually issued a papal bull called the Vox in Rama, which is considered the first official church document condemning black cats as an incarnation of Satan. So a lot of cats were destroyed. A lot of cats were destroyed because of this. Those cats would have killed the rats that prevented the Black Plague. So because of that papal bull, millions died.
Do-do-do-do!
Carrie's Random Facts.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. We'll be back in another fortnight.
With hopefully a happier one.
Yes, we that's why we try and spread out our Dark Cup episodes every 3 weeks. So there's some light in between the darkness for you guys listening, for us researching.
I mean, we talked about Vlad the Impaler impaling an entire village of people just for the lols. And somehow that was less dark than this.
Yes, it was. If you've got any suggestions for any upcoming episodes, please let us know. If there are any other fairy tales you'd like to know the dark roots to, also let us know and we'll do them in a future episode.
Indeed. But for now, thanks for listening.